But right now, it's time for us to talk to Professor Cameron Peter of the Center for Analytics and Behavioral Change, and how they track the changes in us and how we deal. So, sorry, they've launched a 6-month project that will use social media and analytics and advocacy to combat the misinformation about the coronavirus in South Africa and beyond. The project aims to combat the spread news about the COVID-19. So over the next 6 months, a team of 26 among them, I will get Professor Camara to discuss, to explain it himself. Good evening, Professor Camara, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ismail. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, you are from the Center for Analytics and Behavioral Change at UCT.
Yeah, am I also with the Alan Gray Center for Values-Based Leadership at the Graduate School of Business? That's my full-time job.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. But you have an interesting project ahead.
Yes. It's a very interesting project. And, you know, it's been in the works for, you know, several years that we've been working on getting it flighted.
Mm.
And originally, the funding we got was actually to work on racism in South Africa and prejudice, and to look at narrative manipulation in general. So, you know, political narrative manipulation by internal and foreign actors, for example,
but also
narrative manipulation around things like xenophobia. And just as we started going, we got hit with the COVID pandemic.
Yes, as we did.
and we put all our resources onto it immediately.
Yes.
You know, we had to make a call, and we thought this was such an important moment, and there was such, and we knew that there was going to be a lot of misinformation and a lot of abuse of this particular moment for partisan, you know, agendas,
right,
as well as other agendas in society.
Yeah.
So we knew that misinformation would be an issue, but also that narrative manipulation would be an issue. So we launched ourselves into it, and then we were lucky enough to get more funding to work on it full time for over a period of 6 months.
Wow. Well, it's such a rich topic. We live in a world where very many people are very gullible, and there's so much information going around. You don't know what to believe anymore. You don't know where to start grabbing hold of things to base your own analysis on. And I don't know if you heard my little diatribe before you came on the line about the idea that there are very many different responses to this virus pandemic. There's the medical one, sort of medical health one, then there's the immunology and then the science. People throw that word. It's more scientism than scientific. And then the ideological, you know. So we never know where to grab hold of these things. And I guess most of what you're doing tries to disambiguate all of that.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, you know, the main thing is to try and get credible, reliable information to people and to detect where, you know, false narratives are being spun as well as misinformation is being put out, and to directly counter, to track it and to counter it online. So we go beyond the kind of social media analytics.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, you know, facts can be spun in any particular way. So often a lot of the narrative narrative manipulation involves taking part fact and part spin and creating a narrative out of it. And that's why we conduct narrative analysis. So we don't just, you know, look for one piece of information. We spend a lot of time trying to understand the narrative that's emerging and then to find the hooks in that narrative where we can, you know, take people who are being polarized or pushed towards the extremes or being confused and either clarify or bring them to the middle, you know, get them to a more sensible ground where they're willing to listen to other points of view.
So you triangulate the various messages out there into, I don't know if triangulate is the right word, but that's what I imagine you're doing.
So we track it, you know, and we do quite an extensive analysis to try and identify the key narratives that are emerging. Then we identify sub-narratives, and then we start following those. mm-hmm. and to see how they're unfolding and which actors are involved in them, whose are the loudest voices, are there echo chambers building around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we try to devise a strategy after we've analyzed the narratives to try and counter it, either through online dialoguing. We get online and dialogue with people and mobilize social media influencers out there to get into the conversation and break the echo chambers. We arm them with reliable, credible information so that they can go out there and fight the good fight.
Right.
And we also generate content, you know, compelling content that's affective and appeals to people at an emotional level.
So before we, you know, let me just remind our listeners that we're discussing, you know, the Center for Analytics. We have on the line Professor Cameron Peter, and we're discussing the complexity in society and how you actually it becomes increasingly difficult to know what's the truth and what is spin, and what you can use and how you use facts and how some people abuse facts. So if you want to get involved with us, please do so at WhatsApp us at 072-567-1567 or call us at 021-446-0567. Tweet us at Cape Talk. Professor Peter, before we go to one of the questions that I'd like to ask you is, what are we as South Africans talking about online? Say what is trending at the moment?
There's a lot trending. You know, some of the key emerging themes is also around the severity of lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of the harshest lockdowns in the world, so it's been going on for quite a while, and people are, they're raising their voices about it. You know, some people are obviously supportive of it, but also critical of aspects of it that they felt are unduly punitive, you know,
right.
Not being able to buy essential goods and stuff. Especially not being able to get cigarettes and alcohol. that naturally would be an important topic topic of conversation. But the other theme that's very important is this, the fact that there are two lockdown realities in this country mm-hmm. that delineate along the lines of who's middle class and wealthier and who is poor,
right?
And particularly the destitute. And so I think that is the inherent inequality in our society is manifesting in two different experiences of lockdown and two different sets of disgruntlements about it. Beyond disgruntlement, very real, genuine mm-hmm. Concerns.
Right. So how do we, I don't know if this is a fair question to ask you, but how do we compare to the rest of the world? I mean, I know that, you know, I get off when I've got a week ahead, like the week I've got coming, I actually deactivate my account because I have a lot of work to do, because it is such a noisy place, Twitter. And I'm not on Facebook at all. But so are we different from, I don't imagine we're different from the rest of the world.
No, we're very much on par with the rest of the world. I mean, we've had a much stricter lockdown, but we have a lot of activity online, even more so because people are at home right now. I mean, the Twitter conversation just around COVID is about, you know, a million a day. Not all of it is, you know, good quality stuff. There's a lot of fluff in it.
Yes.
And then just on general platforms, it's about 80,000 to 110,000 a day, just on COVID-19 alone.
Right.
So we're talking about it online, and we're sharing opinions, and people get creative. They create memes. They create humorous things to break the tension of being in lockdown and also the fear of this moment. But they're also discussing serious issues like, you know, protection of essential workers and frontline workers. You know, we've had incidents of, you know, policemen and police stations, you know, policemen getting infected and police stations shutting down, checkers workers and other government essential workers as well. Having concerns about their exposure of being on the front lines. So there's quite a lot we're talking about. We're also very psychologized now. We're talking about the psychological impacts of this gender-based violence, for instance, has peaked, you know, it surged, sorry. And so people have all these concerns, you know, and then some concerns will revolve around, you know, the economics of it, you know, like for some contentious ones would be around financial aid and whether the distribution of it is race-based or not, and there are debates around that as well. So there's a lot going on, but we track, in addition to those conversations, we also track conversations that may lead to public unrest or civil unrest as well as public violence. So we're also keeping an eye on protests and looting and arson with a view to developing an understanding that will allow us to be able to not predict but have an indicative model of when we should be a bit more wary about what's transpiring in a particular neighborhood or area or province, for example.
You raise a point there that reminds me of a recording that was put out by a shock jock this week, that which I find it's based on my many years as a journalist and the briefer period as an academic, that seemed to me to be the manipulation of emotion when you say things like people are getting tired of this lockdown, and remember, there are more of us than there are of the police and SADF. You know, there's a threat, latent threat, embedded in that, that's cause for concern. Would you agree with that, or?
Yeah, there are definitely instigators online, and we track that. We try to find out which are artificially amplified so that we can detect if there's any kind of real narrative manipulation going on by nefarious actors. But around those conversations, yes, we did have a peak of violent events towards the end of April. Mm-hmm. But over the last week or so, you know, the conversations around civil unrest and protests and looting and arson have all decreased very significantly, and the incidents have also decreased. So from what we're seeing is there's kind of a parallel there that's quite reliably saying that it's actually dipping. And that conversation is very interesting about it, is it's majority male for the most part of them.
Really?
Yeah, and you know, part of our hypothesis here, our working hypothesis, is that, you know, males are particularly more prone to hype bias.
That's correct. I really enjoy the concept of narrative manipulation, you know, and that sort of it's basically steering the conversation in the direction you want it to go to.
Absolutely, and the reason why this moment is so ripe for it is because we know so little about this virus or how to react to it. I mean, it's reminiscent of the early days of the HIV pandemic,
right,
when no one quite knew what it was, how it was evolving, how to avoid it, and then slowly, in dribs and drabs, information started to appear. And, you know, instead of that information being taken seriously, the discourse became one that was, you know, completely out of kilter with what was actually happening. So, it's a disease that gay people have, or sex workers, or people who are promiscuous.
Right.
And because, you know, we had this kind of, so going to your early point about, you know, how we use facts and how we, you know, we interpret them and tell our own stories with them, this created a situation where many people fell through the cracks and died and did not get the help they needed. And so this moment is a very difficult one to navigate through, because even us as fact checkers are learning new things about this virus every day, along with the medical establishment.
Yes, and it's that's the thing about this, you know, and I'm not by any means a backer of the ruling party or anything, but I must say I do have some sympathy for the presidency, in the sense that, you know, nobody saw this is something new. This is something completely new, this pandemic. It's not like we've all been on a course or we've saw this coming 2 or 3 years ago. You know, it's new, and as you pointed out correctly, we're learning every day. We're learning by our mistakes, and we're learning by the things we're doing right.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, it was entirely correct to invoke a precautionary principle in how we deal with something that's completely unknown.
Right.
But as we learn about not just the virus, but as we learn about lockdown and how people react to it and what people's needs are, and as we start devising new ways of living through this, you know.
Right.
I think then we should start adapting our approach, right, you know, over time.
Do you think the government has been doing enough to counter the fake news and divisive rhetoric?
They've actually done a fantastic job of it. Okay. You know, it turns out that, you know, making it illegal was a very good move. Even though there's still fake news circulating on WhatsApp platforms, but public platforms have actually had very low levels of outright fake news.
Mm-hmm.
And South Africans have also become quite street smart about it, you know. Mm-hmm. Ever since Bell Pottinger ran their campaign, I think the public are a bit more skeptical about things they read online.
We're better attuned for this thing now.
Well, once bitten, twice shy.
So without giving anything away, could you explain how you will use social media analytics to track the spreading of fake news online?
Well, you know, it's very easy. We have a huge piece of very expensive piece of software called BrandWatch, which allows us to basically look at all of social media, all of publicly available platforms globally as well as in South Africa, and we can track it back 10 years and we can do analytics in real time. That's and this allows us to do very powerful analysis of narratives that are emerging online.
Yeah. This week, I don't know if it was this week or last week that you wrote something about the age of complexity and a new world disorder that has dawned. If I may take the liberty of asking you your view on this, what would you call the age of complexity?
Mm-hmm.
So I will put on another cap now, and have we? Has the world or the global economy, global political economy, as I call it, has it not always been complex? I mean, when globalization took off in the 1990s, everybody spoke of how wonderfully integrated we all are. Then some of us remembered, Milton, John Maynard Keynes wrote about globalization in the late 1800s. Well, no, he wrote, you know, when he did, about how integrated the world was in the late 1800s. So are we not hiding behind this concept of complexity? So because it's easy to say, it's very complex.
No, there's more to it than that. I mean, you know what John Maynard Keynes also said. He says, "When the facts change, I change my mind."
Correct. Absolutely.
Right? Absolutely. That's a classic case in coping with complexity.
That's correct.
Facts change all the time. Right now. But what makes you're quite right. The last 3 decades of the 20th century were definitely characterized by increasing levels of complexity and faster rates of change.
Mm-hmm.
Technology, organization, society, urbanization, the works. And it's part of the transition that we've come into the 21st century with.
Mm-hmm.
But what the 21st century is characterized by is greater interconnectivity than we've ever had before, greater interdependence than we've ever had before, and then a range of existential fundamental threats. You know, everything from climate change to resource scarcity to ecosystems degradation to, you know, the kind of population we have and even the kind of politics that is emerging with the disillusionment with central establishments has made for very rocky roads. And what complexity essentially deals with is unpredictable, unprecedented events.
Absolutely.
So wicked problems and wicked challenges that emerge. So that's the heart of it, okay. Why we say it's the era of complexity.
Well, I was also just as you spoke there, thinking about Pankaj Mishra's book, The Age of Anger. And
yes.
But I want to thank you for being available to chat to us tonight, and good luck with your work. And, and this sounds facetious, but good luck finding out or trying to help us what to believe and what not to believe in this.
We all need a bit of luck these days, Ismail. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you.